to differ, Lottie said calmly. With the burden of expense this parish is carrying, I think the media will be very interested in your little deal.
You better discuss it with Bishop Connor, then.
I intend to. Lottie felt like she was in a schoolyard sparring match. Ricard was adept at wheeling and dealing, playing his cards close to his chest. She preferred to go straight to the suit of hearts. I think you bought St. Angela's with strings attached, she said.
Think what you like.
So who was at the meeting at your house yesterday morning?
I've absolutely no idea what you're talking about.
Do you deny there was a meeting?
I don't have to confirm or deny any such thing.
He opened and banged a drawer once again. Were you ever in St. Angela's?
I owned the damn place. Of course I've been in it.
I mean as a child, a young lad. Were you ever in it back,
oh, I don't know, in the 70s?
What? Ricard puffed out his cheeks, heightening the colour from red to purple, sweeping up his jaws, and threw his hands upwards.
Were you?
Lottie noticed damp patches seeping from his armpits. The room was beginning to hum with the smell of his sweat.
No.
I never set foot inside St. Angela's until I became interested in acquiring the property.
Lottie
wasn't convinced. But she'd no way of proving it. Not at the moment, anyway.
You can all you like, he mimicked.
Lottie smiled her sweetest smile and asked, On another matter, do you know your son is dabbling in drugs? She wasn't about to let him away scot-free.
What Jason does or doesn't do has nothing to do with you.
On the contrary, it has everything to do with me, because Mr. Ricard, much as it galls me, he happens to be in a relationship with my daughter. She watched Ricard intently. His mouth opened to fire a reply, but he stopped as if realizing what she had said. The first sign of uncertainty crept into the lines around his tired eyes and his lips slackened. He got up and walked to the window. She had wrong-footed him, at last.
Your daughter?
Yes, my daughter, Katie. Ricard turned round to face her. The wintry sun behind him silhouetted his rounded belly, now slack without his waistcoat to hold it in. Distant traffic sounds reverberated from the street below.
What my son gets up to, or gets up his nose, has no bearing on anything.
And hear this loud and clear, Inspector Parker. I had nothing to do with those murders. If you continue to harass me, I will report you. You and everyone else, Lottie thought. She had heard enough from Tom Ricard. She stood up too. I hope you're not challenging my professionalism. Because I can assure you, Mr. Ricard, I will get to the bottom of this in an honest and transparent way. I don't operate the way you run your business.
And you are implying?
What exactly?
You know exactly what I'm implying. Brown envelopes, backhanders, whispered promises and council corridors. Think what you like about me, but I warn you. Do not underestimate me.
Lottie turned on her heel, snatched up her jacket from the back of the chair, and left him staring out the window of his modern office, listening to the mid-morning traffic far beneath his feet. She almost skipped to the lift. She felt good.
No, not good. Great.
Rushing through the crowded reception back at the station, she bumped into Boyd. He took her arm, turned, and steered her back out the door.
What's up?
Lottie asked, trying to maintain her balance.
Corrigan. He's had a call from Tom Ricard. Something to do with you threatening his family.
That's a load of bollocks, she said, wrestling her arm free. She spun Boyd round to face her.
Total bullshit. Maybe. But a little time out of Corrigan's line of fire mightn't be a bad thing right now.
He gripped her arm. She relented and walked with him to the car. Where are we going? She asked, fastening her seatbelt.
The soup kitchen.
Is that a new restaurant? She asked dryly. Boyd reversed the car.
You know right well it's where Susan Sullivan did her charity work. Lottie calmed down and Boyd switched on the radio. Some rapper blared and she thought of Sean. Am I a bad mother?
No, you're not. Why?
Since Adam died, I can't manage my home life. I've thrown myself into my job. I abandon my kids to their own devices. God knows what Chloe and Sean get up to all day. And Katie's going out with a millionaire's junkie son. I think I'm losing control, Boyd.
It could be worse, he said.
How so?
Katie could be going out with a junkie without the millions.
Chapter 51. Mellow Grove, a local authority estate of 210 grim houses, was a short drive through town. Boyd parked the car outside number 202, an end, pebble-dashed affair, with a small flat roof extension to the side. A young boy, no more than 5 years old, with dirty blonde hair sticking out from under a peaked Manchester United cap, walked up to the front bumper and eyed the two detectives.
"Who are you looking for, mister?"
he asked.
"Mind your own business," said Boyd, pushing open the rusted gate. "Fuck off, you long lank of misery," the boy shouted.
Lottie and Boyd turned, looked at him, then at each other and laughed. A lime green 1992 Fiat Punto was parked outside the wall. Two black cats and a German shepherd sat guard on the step. The woman who opened the door, her body framing its width, had a head of grey hair curled tight to plump, pink cheeks. An unevenly buttoned, knitted cardigan hung over a black polyester midi dress. Swollen legs in elastic stockings led down to well-worn tartan slippers.
"Mrs. Joan Murta?" Lottie inquired. "We rang you a few minutes ago?"
"Did you?"
The woman checked their ID and guided them past her into her home.
"My memory lets me down at times."
She shooed the dog down the path. He stretched and walked away, his warm paws trailing footprints in the snow behind him. Lottie sniffed the scent of fresh baking inside. Entering the kitchen, she spied brown bread resting on a wire rack.
"Would you like some?"
Mrs. Murta asked, noticing Lottie's line of sight. Without waiting for a reply, she sliced up half the loaf, placed it on a plate and took the lid off a butter dish. A wooden walking stick hung unused from the table edge. She moved surprisingly quickly, and Lottie thought she was probably around her mother's age.
"Heat up,"
Mrs. Murta said. She poured boiling water from the kettle into a teapot.
"You both look like you could do with a decent feed."
"Thank you." Lottie buttered the bread and took a bite. "Delicious trisome," she told Boyd.
"I'm on a diet," he said, taking out his notebook and pen.
Mrs. Murta broke into a robust laugh.
"Diet me whole," she said.
She looked over to Lottie.
"Dangerous job for a woman, being in the guards."
She placed the teapot on the table and sat down. Lottie fingered her damaged nose. "I like my job."
"I bet you're good at it too,"
Mrs. Murta said, pouring black tea into three mugs.
"When did you first meet Susan Sullivan?" Boyd asked, looking around for milk.
"You'll have to bear with me. I'm liable to forget important stuff, early Alzheimer's, my doctor thinks. So let me think. It must have been 5 or 6 months ago."
Mrs. Murta munched the bread. Crumbs stuck to facial hairs at the corner of her lips.
"Susan heard about my charity work with the homeless. I was fundraising for a shelter, wanted to convert the extension at the side of my house into a type of hostel. Did you notice it on the way in? Poor Ned, my late husband, built that himself, God love him. A heap of crap it was."
Lottie nodded. Mrs. Murta continued.
"The council stopped me. Said it wouldn't be in keeping with the general area. I know the neighbours complained. Got a campaign up and running to oppose me, they did. Didn't really matter in the end. I hadn't enough money at the time."
"What did Susan do?" Lottie asked.
"She called to see me. Wanted to help. gave me 10,000 euros straight up. Cash. No questions asked. You don't look a gift horse in the mouth, do you? I got the extension renovated and installed a restaurant-style cooker. Kitted it out top-notch, I did. And we started our own soup kitchen.
Mrs. Murta sipped her tea, her face alight with pride.
Did I show you?
Maybe later, Lottie thought.
How did you operate it?
When Mrs. Murta raised an eyebrow, Lottie said, the soup kitchen.
Oh, we cooked up the broth, poured it into flasks and drove around town delivering it to the poor unfortunates. A few of them live on the streets, and there's another crowd down by the industrial estate, you know, along the canal, behind the train station.
Lottie knew. Her ribs still ached from the mugging.
Did Susan give you any idea why she was doing this?
Lottie buttered a second slice of bread. If Boyd wasn't going to eat, it was his loss.
She wanted to help those who couldn't help themselves. Concerned with children, sleeping rough, she was. It's a national disgrace what's going on in this country, so it is. All those houses boarded up, and the poor have nowhere to sleep.
Mrs. Murta banged her fist on the table, eyes flaring. Her passion surprised Lottie. Pity they weren't more like her, she thought.
Susan ranted on about developers building all those ghost houses. Said it was criminal the way the council allowed them to carry on,
Mrs. Murta said. Lottie looked at Boyd. He returned a knowing look. But she worked for the council, Lottie said.
I know, but she never had the final say. That's what she told me.
Did she ever mention Tom Ricard? He's a developer.
I'm not stupid, just forgetful. I know who he is, with his snooty wife and junky kid, looking down their noses at us mere mortals. I tell you, I've more wealth in my heart than Tom Ricard will ever have in his bank account, Detective Dotty.
She slammed the lid back on the butter dish.
Did you have a run-in with him? Asked Boyd.
Lottie caught his smirk as Mrs. Murta's inaccurate mention of her name. She ignored him.
Not personally, but I know his kind, Mrs. Murta said. Susan didn't have much time for him anyway.
Why not?
Asked Lottie.
Something to do with Owen St. Angela's. That's the big empty orphanage place out the road. She mentioned one time about him buying his way through the development plan. I don't know what that means, but I can make a fairly good guess.
Lottie drained the remnants of her tea. Mrs. Murta started to refill the mugs. How many people are involved in the soup kitchen? Asked Boyd, declining the tea.
Just me. Now Susan's gone. I don't know how long I can keep it going with no money coming in.
Lottie had a feeling that Mrs. Murta would keep her soup kitchen going until the day she died, money or no money.
Have you any idea why someone would want to kill Susan? Boyd asked.
I don't know.
The woman shook her head sadly.
She was a decent soul. Only wanted to do good for people. It's a mystery to me.
She wiped tears from her eyes.
A lot of things are a mystery to me nowadays.
She must have spoken to you about her life. Had she any worries or concerns?
She told me she was dying. I've never met anyone who accepted a death sentence like she did. Resigned to her fate, she was.
Did she ever tell you where the cash came from?
Cash?
Mrs. Murta was silent, thinking for a moment.
Yes. She said it was owed to her, from a long time ago. Everyone pays in the end. Susan said that. Funny how I can remember these things and not others. You know, I have a feeling there's something else I need to be telling you, but I can't remember for the life of me.
Lottie digested the information.
Did anyone have a grudge against her?
Asked Boyd, tapping his notebook impatiently.
Susan was a quiet soul. Just wanted to help people. I don't know why anyone would want to harm her.
Did she have a boyfriend or partner? Lottie asked.
Not that I know of.
Did you know she'd been in St. Angela's as a child? The older woman was silent for a time, nodding away to herself.
She told me it was a terrible place. No child should be abandoned by a mother the way she was. Said she was one of the lucky ones, if you could call being scarred all your life lucky. The Catholic Church has a lot to answer for in this country. She shook her head wearily.
What did she tell you about the search for her child? Asked Lottie.
Broke her heart, it did, them taking away her chiseler. She was never sure what actually happened to her Bobby.
So she'd no luck tracing it?
She went through every avenue available and got nowhere. The biggest obstacle was the church. She even met the bishop. Fat lot of good that did her.
Anger flashed in the old woman's eyes once again. She met Bishop Connor?
Lottie nudged Boyd on the elbow. The bishop had denied knowing Susan, and now it appeared he'd actually met with her.
Yes, she did. Let me think for a minute.
Mrs. Murta closed her eyes and said,
When she came back here afterwards, she was very upset. So I couldn't understand why she returned for a second time.
A second time? When? Why? Asked Lottie, itching now to have another go at Bishop Connor.
I dunno. I told her not to go back, but she was adamant he had information.
Mrs. Murta dropped her eyes.
Poor soul. That man told her she was nothing only a slut, and said that's why she must have been put in St. Angela's. He's a bastard. God forgive me.
Mrs. Murta blessed herself again. Lottie digested this information.
Why had Bishop Connor lied?
When was his second meeting, Mrs. Murta?
Christmas. Yes, it was before Christmas.
Any idea when exactly?
Susan was on annual leave from the council. Christmas Eve, that's it. We had three pots boiling on the big cooker.
Did I show you the cooker?
Of course I didn't. Remind me before you go. Normally, one or two pots would be the maximum.
Funny how I can remember that when there's so much I can't.
It was snowing like the dickens, and the weatherman said it was going to be -12 or something ridiculous like that. So yes, I'm fairly sure it was Christmas Eve.
Boyd made a note.
How did she get on at the second meeting?
Lottie asked, taking another bite of bread. She hadn't realised how hungry she was.
I don't think I even asked her.
When she came back, we filled the flasks, loaded my car and off with us, through the blizzard.
Had her mood changed?
How do you mean?
After her visit with the bishop. Was she troubled or upset?
I imagine she was the same Susan as always. Troubled. Very troubled.
Lottie thought about Bishop Connor and felt an increasing sympathy for Susan Sullivan. She had been wronged throughout her life, and the more she learned about her, the more determined she became to afford Susan some sort of justice, albeit too late.
When did you last see Susan? Boyd asked.
The night before her murder.
Mrs. Murta wiped another tear from the corner of her eye.
We did our soup runs every night over the Christmas.
She was off work, Lottie said. So what did she do during the days?
I don't know. Susan kept to herself.
She lived at the opposite end of town. But her car looks like it hadn't been moved in weeks. Did she walk everywhere?
She liked her exercise. Always had that music thing in her ears. What do you call it?
An iPod.
Loved her music, she did, Mrs. Murta said wistfully.
Anything else you can tell us? Lottie asked.
2 cups of wholemeal flour, 1 teaspoon of yeast, 1 tablespoon of butter, 1 pinch of salt and 20 minutes in the oven.
I'm afraid I don't bake, Lottie said. And even if I did, I don't think I could ever make bread as delicious as this. She wondered if the old woman was changing the subject. She dreaded the thought of her mother ever getting Alzheimer's. Or maybe it might be a good thing.
Hard to know with Rose Fitzpatrick.
You're trying to flatter me. I'll get some tinfoil and you can bring the rest of the loaf home with you.
Lottie began to protest, but decided it was too good an offer to refuse. Wrapping the bread, Mrs. Murta said,
And you, young man, you could do with a slice or two.
Boyd smiled and remained silent, Lottie returned to the conversation. I'm led to believe St. Angela's was a brutal place. What did Susan tell you about it?
She told me something one time. Said she'd never told a living soul. A baby was murdered there, and a young lad was beaten to death.
Mrs. Murta made the sign of the cross, forehead, chest and shoulders, slowly and deliberately.
She called it the baby jail. All them little mites and cots with iron bars. And she wasn't sure if it was her baby that was murdered, but she convinced herself it wasn't.
She paused, tears damp on her cheeks.
Not knowing, that was the worst. The poor tormented soul. Do you know, she bought the newspaper every day to look at the photographs. Thought she might recognise her child, all grown up now.
We saw the newspapers in her house, said Boyd.
Obsessed, she was. As if she could recognise someone she only saw as a babby. I tried talking to her, but she said if she saw a picture, she would know.
Dismissing the futility of Susan's newspaper quest, Lottie said, Patrick O'Malley. Did you ever hear of him?
Of course. A demented man. One of our soup clients,
Mrs. Murta said.
Susan was very kind to him, but never spoke to me about him. Detective, I only knew Susan for the last 6 months of her life, but it felt like I knew her forever. It's so sad. Why do these things happen to the good people, and the bad bastards walk around scot-free?
Lottie and Boyd said nothing. There wasn't much they could add to that. The woman rose, gathered the three mugs, placed them in the sink, turned on the tap and rinsed them under the flowing water. Leaving them to dry in the draining board, she picked up her walking stick and pointed to the side door.
Come on, I'll show you our soup kitchen. We were so proud of it.
Lottie hadn't the heart to refuse. All four wheels intact, and the foul-mouthed little boy was nowhere in sight.
That's some setup, said Boyd, starting up the car.
Wherever Susan got the money from, it seems she put it into the soup kitchen. Lottie placed the bread at her feet. I hope whatever Mrs. Murta can't remember to tell us is nothing too important.
We need to go through Susan's phone records again.
For sure.
Where to next? Asked Boyd.
Or can I guess?
Bishop Terence Connor, said Lottie. He has some explaining to do.
Chapter 52. I see you have brought the cavalry with you, Inspector.
Bishop Connor indicated two chairs in front of his desk. Lottie and Boyd sat.
When are you going to release Father Angelotti's body?
He asked.
That's up to the pathologist, Lottie said. Is there anything you can add to our investigation regarding his murder?
I am devastated, he said. To think he was only here a few weeks, then this abomination happens.
Why was he at James Brown's home?
I have no idea.
Did he ever mention James Brown or Susan Sullivan to you?
Lottie pressured.
He never mentioned anything, Inspector. He barely communicated with me.
Did he have access to a car?
I am sure he could have got one if he needed it.
But there was no car at Mr. Brown's house. How did he get there?
Connor hesitated. Imperceptible eye movement, but Lottie caught it.
A taxi? He said. I'm sure you can check with the local companies.
Doing it as we speak, Lottie said, making a mental note to follow this up. You told me you'd no knowledge of Susan Sullivan. Is that correct?
She asked, flicking through her notebook, for effect rather than substance. The intense green eyes that had tried to intimidate her on her first visit were now eyeing her with suspicion.
I believe that to be correct, he said, emulating Lottie's words.
You need to think very carefully, she emphasized. I have proof you met with Miss Sullivan on at least two occasions. hearsay, but he didn't know that.
And what proof might that be?
The bishop's eyes flared. Lottie gave Boyd the floor. He was better at fudging the truth.
We have phone records proving Susan Sullivan rang you. And her computer diary detailing a scheduled meeting with you, Boyd said, bluffing with confidence. I thought you could not find her phone. Bishop Connor sat back and smiled.
And how would you know whether we did or not? Asked Lottie.
My sources are very good.
Your sources are incorrect, and you lied to me, Lottie said.
I did not know Susan Sullivan. I will admit, however, that I did meet with her. There is a difference between knowing someone and meeting with them.
He caressed his fingers over his smooth chin. You're being evasive. I could arrest you for obstruction.
Arsehole, thought Lottie. I do not believe I have any information that could help you, said the bishop.
Let me be the judge of that. What were the meetings about? She was fed up with the pussyfooting.
Private matters. I do not have to tell you anything further.
Bishop Connor, you were acquainted with two of our three murder victims, one of whom, Susan Sullivan, I know met with you. The other, Father Angelotti, was in your care. And you say you don't have to tell us anything? Lottie kept her voice strong and challenging. The longer you play this game, the more I think you're guilty of something. And believe me, if I get a sniff that you're giving us the runaround, you might begin to experience what hell on earth is like. She leaned forward, breathing rapidly.
Are you threatening me, Inspector?
The bishop returned her glare. Boyd broke the confrontation.
We're not threatening you, Bishop Connor. We're telling it like it is, and we'd like to know why you denied having met with Susan Sullivan. You must admit it all looks very suspicious.
Bishop Connor took a breath and reclined into the comfort of his chair. Lottie remained forward, coiled so tight she could spring across the desk any minute. Boy put a hand on her arm. She refused to move. Damned if she would let Connor away this time.
And don't invoke the superintendent threat, she said. I don't give a flying fuck how many golf balls you and Superintendent Corrigan have hit together. Or how many whiskies you've downed on the 19th hole. Or how many birdies, eagles or albatrosses you can claim. It doesn't wash with me. I want answers. If I've to haul your unholy arse down to the station, so be it. But one way or another, you'll talk to me.
Bishop Connor smiled, incensing Lottie further. Boyd said, Allow me to outline our position. Father Angelotti arrived here from Rome on December 1st. On Christmas Eve, you met with Susan Sullivan following a meeting earlier in the year. Our best estimate is that Father Angelotti was murdered on Christmas Eve. I think it's time you started talking.
And I think it's time for you to leave, Bishop Connor said.
What are you hiding? Asked Lottie, keeping her eyes locked on the bishop's darting emeralds.
I have nothing to hide, he said, a pink shadow creeping up his cheekbones. But you won't talk to us, Boyd said. I am busy, if you would be so kind.
He pointed to the door, his phone already in his hand. You're wasting your time talking to Superintendent Corrigan, Lottie said, stomping out the door.
And you are wasting your time talking to me.
He shut the door behind them. Settling into the car, Lottie said, If I was so inclined, I could murder that bastard myself.
Me too, said Boyd. And how do you know so much about golf?
Sean went through a Rory McIlroy phase with his PlayStation games.
Boyd nodded as if he understood.
Connor's hiding something. Lottie said.
I need a drink, Boyd said.
Lottie looked out over the lake as they drove away, the water rippling silver under the moon's reflection. It's almost 7. I should check in at home. Boyd concentrated on the road. On second thoughts, why not? She said,
reclining the seat. She planted her feet on the dashboard and closed her eyes. He remained quiet. She was glad of his silence. Ricard and Connor were giving her the runaround, and after today, she was convinced that they were hiding something. But what? She was almost certain it related to St. Angela's. She didn't know if it had to do with the past or the present. One thing was sure, though. She was determined to find out. She owed it to the victims. Chapter 53. The man left his office saying he'd be back in an hour. He needed fresh air, even if it was full of tumbling snow. As he strolled through the half-deserted town, a teenage couple laughing and leaning into each other rushed past him. A blast of wind lifted the scarf from the boy's neck and the girl tugged it around her own. The black tattoo stood out against the white flakes falling from the sky. The man idled at a shop window as the girl pulled the boy towards her and the two kissed. He could see her pale hands rub along the youth's thighs, then move upwards until they were caressing his neck. He tried to control his breathing. It was so loud he thought they would hear it. The neck. The tattoo. That beautiful boy. The young couple resumed their walk and headed into Danny's bar. He needed to touch that skin. Soon. Chapter 54. Detectives Larry Kirby and Maria Lynch were already in Danny's bar, sitting in front of the fire, when Lottie and Boyd arrived. Two pints of Guinness held centre stage on the round table beside Kirby, his hair wilder than usual. Lynch was drinking a hot whiskey. A hum of chatter filled the air and a group of teenagers, piercings and tattoos highlighting their pale skin, sat in a semicircle in a dim corner. A pot of tea with a multitude of cups and saucers cluttered their table. Tea time in the zoo, thought Lottie, easing in between her two detectives. She passed no more heed on the youngsters. Boyd went to order the drinks.
You drinking for two, Kirby? Lottie asked.
I'm sitting here thinking about the second one, he said, taking off his jacket, ready for a session. A wad of paper and three chewed biros stuck out of his shirt pocket.
And the first one?
It'll go down so quick I won't even remember drinking it.
He took the pint, raised it to the two women either side of him, and downed the drink in three swallows. He wiped his mouth with the back of his rough hand and put the empty glass back on the table.
Needed that, he said.
Lottie smiled across at Lynch. Boyd arrived with a glass of red wine for himself and white for Lottie.
I thought you didn't drink any more,
Kirby said, white, frothy Guinness lingering on his upper lip.
This isn't any more, said Lottie. This is now. I need it as much as you needed that first pint.
Totally agree with you, said Kirby,
taking a large gulp, following it with a loud belch, without any trace of embarrassment. The four detectives drank their alcohol, and the blazing fire restored heat to their bodies.
Don't look now, Inspector, Lynch said, nodding behind Lottie with a swish of her ponytail. But your daughter is sitting in the corner.
Lottie turned immediately.
Katie!
She was lounging with her head on Jason Ricard's shoulder. Her eyes were tired slits, while a smirk curled at the corner of her pouting red lips. Her face, artificially pale from intense white foundation, challenged Lottie.
Stay where you are, advised Boyd.
I've no intention of moving. I've had enough confrontation for one day.
Sipping the illicit wine, Lottie really wanted to slaughter it, like Kirby had with his pint. She didn't have his gut, though, and needed to be able to walk home. Katie could wait. But she was annoyed that Maria Lynch was a witness to her family's strife. She turned to her colleagues and told them about the progress she and Boyd had made.
Give me 5 minutes with that bishop and he'll talk, said Kirby, licking his lips.
How was your day? Lottie asked,
studiously ignoring the teenagers behind her.
I had a bit of a bingo moment, said Kirby. I reviewed Brown's phone records and discovered some of the calls he made were to a mobile number belonging to none other than Father Angelotti.
James Brown knew Father Angelotti. Lottie finished her wine with a gulp. So we now have a conclusive link between James Brown and the dead priest. She placed the empty glass on the table. When was this? What date?
Dates, Kirby corrected her. There were a few calls. Mid-November was the first one. Hold on.
He extracted the sheaf of papers from his shirt pocket and unfurled them. Yellow highlighter illuminated the pages, circling a myriad of numbers.
Here it is, Kirby said, pointing with a stubby finger. November 23rd at 6:15 p.m. And two others. December 2nd and December 24th.
What time on December 24th? Asked Lottie, feeling a surge of excitement.
10:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m., said Kirby, taking one of his pens and drawing yet another circle around the digits.
And according to our pathologist's best guess, Father Angelotti was murdered on Christmas Eve, said Lottie.
And Susan Sullivan met with the bishop on Christmas Eve. Even though the pretentious bastard refuses to tell us what it was about, said Boyd.
What ties all this together? Lynch asked.
St. Angela's, and the developer Tom Ricard.
Lottie threw a glance over her shoulder at Ricard's son. He was nuzzling her daughter's neck. She turned away, wrinkling her nose in disgust.
How does Father Angelotti fit in? Boyd asked.
I don't know yet, but we could presume Brown rings him at 10:30 a.m. to arrange to meet, and called later to say he couldn't make it back in time, Lottie said. That's the appointment his lover Derek Hart referred to.
But Father Angelotti was already there, Boyd said. And someone else also.
Apparently, said Lottie.
Who?
A barman came between them to tip a bucket of coal onto the fire. The flames dampened momentarily and then leapt up the chimney. Sparks settled on the hearth in front of the detectives. Kirby ordered another round. The four of them settled into silence. A burst of laughter among the chatter behind them ruptured the air.
Lottie tried to concentrate on Kirby's information. At the same time, she wanted to know what her daughter was up to. She looked down at her empty glass, willing the barman to return with the refills. She noticed the frayed edges on her t-shirt sleeves. If Adam was still alive, she'd have more money. Was it the Ricard kid's wealth that attracted Katie?
The drinks arrived. Boyd passed them around. Kirby paid. Lottie heard laughter behind her again. She twisted around. Katie was looking straight through her. The girl's mouth open, displaying a tongue piercing, reflecting the firelight.
When did she get that?
Jason had his arm around Katie's shoulder, fingering her collarbone. When she felt Boyd tugging her arm, Lottie realized she'd stood up.
Leave her be, he said. She's just a kid having fun.
What would you know about it? Lottie snapped, brushing Boyd's hand away.
Not much, I agree. But I do know this. Making a scene with your daughter in front of her friends is the wrong move. Sit down. She did. Boyd was right, of course.
She sighed and allowed the wine to layer a thin numbness onto her brain.
I hate to say this, but your other daughter, Chloe, isn't it? She's just walked in, Lynch said.
Sweet Jesus.
Lottie swung around in her chair. Chloe waved and walked over.
Hello, Mother,
said Chloe.
She nodded at the other detectives. So this is your busy schedule?
Sarcasm doesn't suit you, said Lottie. Where's Sean?
Well, he's not with me.
Obviously,
retorted Lottie, quoting one of Chloe's favourite words.
He's at home.
We had pot noodles for lunch, said Chloe, lingering behind her mother's chair.
Yuck, said Boyd, turning up his nose.
What are you doing here?
Asked Lottie, feeling the guilt trip her daughter was sending her on. You're underage.
"Stating the obvious, Mother," said Chloe, pulling at the string of a pink hoodie underneath her white puff jacket. She looked 12, not 16. "I'm looking for Katie, and now I found her." "I think you should go home," said Lottie, aware they were now the focus of hushed attention. "Wait for me outside. I'll catch up with you in a minute." Chloe turned, her blonde hair bobbing on top of her head, and she marched out of the pub. "Don't fret about them," said Lynch. "Things will get better." "When?" asked Lottie. "That's what I'd like to know. It goes from bad to worse." Was that a smirk she noticed on Lynch's lips? She needed to keep a closer eye on Lynch. She didn't think she could trust her at all. Ignoring her unfinished wine, she pulled on her jacket. "I'll see you all at 6 in the morning. Thanks for the drinks I owe you." "Need a lift?" asked Boyd. He remained seated. "We'll walk. I want to clear my head. Thanks anyway."
"Watch out for muggers," said Kirby.
Lottie stopped for a moment in front of Katie and her friends, said nothing, kept going. Boyd, Kirby and Lynch said nothing either. They sipped their drinks, listening to the fire crackling. Outside the pub, pulling up her hood against the blizzard, Lottie thought it was sometimes easier to battle against the weather than the tumultuous storms raging within her. Chloe linked her hand through her arm, and at last Lottie felt warm. The man stayed in the dark nook, obscured from the general crowd, until the detectives finally left the bar following another round of drinks. He was sure they hadn't noticed him, but it was getting to the stage where he didn't really care one way or the other. When the youth with the neck tattoo went to the bar, he joined him. "Buy you a pint?" he asked, ordering one for himself.
"No, thanks. I'm with the crowd."
"You sure?" He waved a 50.
"Would you ever piss off?"
The man stared into the dark eyes for a moment before paying for his pint and pocketing the change. And as he moved away, making it appear as accidental as he could, he brushed his hand down the young lad's spine, feeling the vertebrae beneath the cotton t-shirt.
"Oh, sorry," he said. "Bit crowded here tonight." "Fuck off, you pervert."
The man returned to the nook, his fingers tingling and his body hardening. The anticipation was too much to bear. He would have to do something about it. Chapter 55. Tom Rickard sat on the edge of the bed tying his shoelaces.
"Have I told you how beautiful you are?" he said.
"Only every 5 seconds in the last hour," the woman said, her long hair framing her face. "Tom, I don't know how much longer I can do this." He sighed as she pulled the sheet up to her neck, her damp body seductively outlined beneath it, and a silver chain hanging down one glistening shoulder.
"Don't say that."
He turned and, leaning over, kissed her roughly on the lips. She struggled to a sitting position, the sheet falling away to expose her flesh, warm and inviting. He wanted her again. Had he time? "It's getting too difficult making up excuses," she said. "And some day, someone is going to see us coming and going from here." She paused. "Tom, are you listening to me? Look at this place. How long can we keep this up? I hate it." He didn't trust himself to speak. He picked up his jacket from the narrow wooden chair and slipped it over his creased purple shirt. He scanned the room, seeing it for what it was. An inadequate, two-bar electric heater in a corner, peeling paint dripping from the damp ceiling and cracked floorboards which had, more than once, resulted in cupped feet for both of them. His lust had conjured the room into a lover's paradise. The beautiful creature on the creaking bed deserved more than an ancient dormitory. But they were too well known to have their trysts in hotels. Definitely not now, with Melanie sniffing around him. "Can we discuss this another time?" He sat back on the edge of the bed. "There's no need to talk to me like I'm one of your junior employees."
You can't just schedule me in your appointments diary for a quickie and then bugger off to Mrs. Versace Ricard. We shouldn't even be in here, regardless of what we're doing when we're here. She slumped onto the damp pillow and closed her eyes. Give me a while longer. I'm working things out. Honestly. We'll make it work. Together. And how do you propose to do that? Get real, Tom. You are pathetic. You want out? He asked, horrified she might actually agree. No. Yes, I don't know. This isn't right. She squeezed her eyes shut. Soon, very soon, I'm nearly there. Don't do anything rash, not yet. Give me time. Her eyes flashed open, and he shivered under the intensity of her gaze. Then she appeared to relent. Give me a kiss, and I'll get dressed. We can leave together. This place turns my blood cold. He leaned over, ran his tongue along her shoulder, sucking on the chain in the curve, locked his mouth on hers and assaulted her with a violent kiss. A sharp scream escaped from her lips, and he realized he had drawn blood from her mouth. "Why did you do that?" she cried, pushing him away. She jumped out of the bed, pulled on her underwear. The smell of sex clung to her skin, musky, like yesterday's perfume. "Sometimes I wonder about you," she spat, disgust lacing every word. "I'm sorry," he said. The frustration of not being able to touch her last night at the ball bulged like a tumour inside him. He couldn't get enough of her. "I'm sorry," he repeated. "So am I. I'm sorry I got involved in this sordid mess." She zipped up her dress. "I'm not sure I want to be with you any longer." "Don't say that. I love you. We are meant for each other," he pleaded. "You see, that's what I mean." She buttoned her cardigan, then her coat. "You can be so immature. I've been through this before. I've watched men crumble under the weight of affairs. And you're turning out exactly like the rest." He watched her fasten the belt on her coat. When she laughed at him, it cut right through him. He stood with his mouth open. "Oh, come on now. You honestly don't think this is my first time in this kind of situation. Grow up." She laughed once more, picked up her handbag and pulled it onto her shoulder. "You need to find another place for your regular shag. I'm never setting foot in here again." She banged the door. The windows rattled, and he felt his heart shrink. Sitting down on the stained sheets, Tom Ricard shook his head. First Melanie losing it, now his lover. Add to the mix the financial mess he would be in if the St. Angela's project failed, plus Detective Inspector Lottie Parker with her bloodhound nose. And he wondered how things could possibly get any worse. Then he started to laugh. He had faced worse and had come out the other side. This time would be no different. He was a fixer, and he would fix this. Chapter 56. It was snowing hard as they walked home, and the cold air helped dilute the wine in Lottie's bloodstream. She trudged along with her daughter in silence. It was too miserable to talk, constantly looking over her shoulder to ensure she wasn't being followed. She didn't want to be paranoid, but she still worried the mugger might strike again. At home, she hung her jacket on the banister of the stairs, and Chloe went into the sitting room. Sean was lying on the couch, flicking through indiscriminate television channels. Chloe flounced onto the chair opposite him, arms folded. The room was warm, the atmosphere cold. "I'm sorry," said Lottie. "I should have come straight home after work. But it was a long day and I needed to unwind first." She leaned against the door watching her children. Why did she have to explain herself? Guilt? Chloe lunged out of the chair and skipped over to her. "No,
I'm sorry, she said, wrapping her arms around Lottie, hugging her. I was worried you might be on a binge. That's the real reason I went to the pub. Lottie welcomed her daughter's concern. You don't need to fret over me, she said. I only had a couple. I won't be making it a regular occurrence.
You needn't think I'm going to hug you, said Sean, smiling at them over his shoulder.
I need a new PlayStation.
It's only 2 years old. What's wrong with it? Asked Lottie, freeing herself from Chloe.
It keeps freezing.
Niall looked at it and said it's almost at the red light of death.
It can't be fixed, said Sean.
And I've had it 4 years, not two. I got it way before Dad died.
And Niall is an expert, is he?
Lottie knew Sean's best friend was a master at taking things apart and building them up again. She hoped he was wrong.
Red light of death?
What the hell was that?
Her budget wouldn't stretch to a new PlayStation.
He is an expert.
When can I have a new one? Sean beseeched, the little boy in him overriding the teenager.
I have some money in the bank.
You can't touch your money. You know it's held in a trust fund until you reach 21. She had invested Adam's small life insurance money in special accounts for the children.
I know that, but I have a few hundred in my own account, Sean sulked.
I'll see what I can do.
You're back in school in a few days, so you'll be studying, she said hopefully.
No time for PlayStation then.
I'll die without FIFA and GTA. There's nothing on the telly.
Lottie sighed. Maybe she should cancel her Sky subscription.
Come on, Chloe. Let's see if there's anything besides pot noodles in the kitchen.
Sean returned to his channel hopping, settling on a rerun of Breaking Bad. Lottie wasn't sure if it was suitable for a 13-year-old, but hadn't the energy to protest.
Chapter 57 Mike O'Brien had left the bank in a foul mood, after he had dispatched Ricard's loans account to head office. He knew there could be repercussions. One day. Not yet, though. He had massaged the figures as best he could. Now he had to wait and hope the account might get lost in Cyberworld. The diversion on his way home had done little to assuage his temper. He sat with his orange-striped cat on his knee, as he did most nights. Classical music filled the air from the music system speakers. It usually served to relax him. Not tonight. Chewing his nails, he stroked the purring creature. Most of his life was spent alone. He liked it that way. Loneliness and aloneness went hand in hand with him. He'd never been one for forming friendships, let alone relationships. He'd had a few acquaintances at the gym, Boyd the detective included. But they were not friends. His sexual inadequacies warped his sense of belonging. He had learned to live with it, found ways to supplement it. Not always tastefully, but he survived. And another couple of months before the hurling season resumed. He missed training the young lads. The activity helped fill the spring evenings. The doorbell sounded, screeching into his reverie. Flinging the cat to the ground, O'Brien looked around wildly. Had head office sent the crime squad already? Could they be onto his fraudulent activity with the Ricard loan so quickly? That was insane. Not at 9 o'clock at night. He switched off the music, flicked back the curtain and peered into darkness. Living on the outskirts of town had its disadvantages, particularly since his home was in the middle of a Ricard ghost estate. 25 houses, encased behind high walls, was the original plan, but only half were completed, and the erection of intercom gates had not transpired. The remainder struggled against rusted scaffolding, and wind howled through windowless concrete. The sound resonated through O'Brien's skull. Pulling back from the window, his reflection in the glass was all that remained. He let the curtain fall and smoothed down its creases. The doorbell rang a second time. He cursed
and went to answer it. Bishop Connor had an anxious scowl scrawled on his face.
"Let me in before someone sees me," he said, pushing past O'Brien.
"What's wrong?" asked O'Brien, his smile faltering. He closed the door, having first checked no one else was outside.
"I hate cats."
Bishop Connor walked straight into the living room, eyeing the ginger cowering beneath the Queen Anne chair. O'Brien clenched his hands into tight fists. This was his home.
"I'll take your coat,"
he said, rescuing it from the back of the couch where Connor had dropped it. A cat hair clung to the shoulder. O'Brien plucked it away and hung the coat in the hall. He returned to find Connor holding a fragile ladro ornament of a young boy.
"Your decor could do with a facelift," Connor said, returning the ceramic piece to the mantel.
"It serves me well. I don't see any reason to waste money unnecessarily."
"Ah, yes. Ever the banker."
"Drink?" asked O'Brien. He poured generous fingers of whiskey into two crystal tumblers and handed one to Connor. They clinked glasses, remained standing, and sipped the alcohol.
"That interfering Inspector Lottie Parker is poking her nose around," said Connor.
"She has a job to do."
"She knows I met that Sullivan woman, and she's snooping about Father Angelotti."
"That had nothing to do with you," O'Brien said.
"Did it?" "I do not need her joining any more dots."
"What about your friend? Superintendent Corrigan, won't he help?"
"I think I have exhausted that line of friendship."
"Sit." O'Brien indicated a chair. The cat sulked beneath it.
"I will stand," said Connor, taking up centre position in the room.
O'Brien's legs felt weak. He needed to sit, but remained standing.
"What do you want me to do?" "Get her off my back. We need to transfer her focus somewhere else."
"And what do you propose?" O'Brien asked, a sense of helplessness swamping him. His throat constricted, so he swallowed another draught of whiskey. Lottie Parker had ridiculed him in his own office yesterday. He'd like to make her pay for that, but what could he do?
"What about Tom Rickard? What does he have to say?" "I am talking to you, not Rickard," said Connor, his voice a shaft of steel.
The room seemed smaller with the bishop in it. O'Brien perspired uncontrollably and the glass slipped slightly in his hand. He placed it on the mantelpiece behind him.
"You and I know how important it is that nothing is uncovered."
With one step, Connor moved into O'Brien's personal space. He flicked a flake of dandruff from the banker's shoulders.
"Secrets have to remain just that. Secrets."
O'Brien stepped back. His ankle collided with the fire guard. He had nowhere to go. Both men stood eye to eye. The sour whiskey odour turned his stomach. Connor's neck was naked of any religious colour, and his carotid artery throbbed visibly in his pulsing throat. He watched it expand and contract, hypnotised, imagining it pumping blood into the bishop's heart, if he had one. He held his breath.
"What do you mean?" O'Brien asked eventually. "Do I have to spell it out for you?"
"No. No. I don't think so." Connor's eyes darkened. He put his glass beside the ladro boy and planted his two hands on O'Brien's shoulders.
"Good. I can't afford to lose out on this deal," said Connor. "You are the money man. You see to it that my finances and everything else remain untraceable."
Each word reverberated throughout the room. He gave O'Brien a shake, removed his hands, picked up his whiskey glass, drained it and replaced it on the mantel. He turned away. Only then did O'Brien exhale.
"I hate cats,"
Connor said again on his way out to the hall. O'Brien didn't speak. He couldn't. The odour from the bishop's breath almost suffocated him. He rested against the fireplace for support. Connor put on his coat.